Hello, welcome to Pathways, where you're invited to join us for a visit with leaders in personal and cultural transformation. This is Renee Poindexter, and I'm sitting in for Pathways host Paul O'Brien. Today I have a fabulous guest to introduce to you. His name is Illyrian Mikhurlyov, and Illyrian is the author of the fabulous book called Wisdom Keeper, One Man's Journey to Honor the Untold Story of the Yunnan People. Illyrian is also a speaker and his key leader for almost four decades in serving his people, the Aleuts of the Pribilof Islands and other indigenous peoples in a number of capacities, locally, statewide, nationally, and internationally. For his entire career, Illyrian Mikhurlyov has been a passionate advocate for indigenous rights, wisdom, and harmonious relationship with Earth Mother. His reach has been broad and varied. He's given keynote speeches and forums at the National Academy of Sciences annual meeting, Pan-Pacific University Presence Association, and many other Native and American Indian environments. He has also lectured on traditional ways of knowing and the indigenous elder wisdom. Illyrian, it's just a pleasure to have you with us today. Thank you so much for being here.
Well, Angwan, Renee, and to your listeners, Ting Unanganway, Unanganasakta Kuyach, Amakanta Sakta Illyrian Mikhurlyov, Kaulangan Unanganway. I said, hello, my other self, which is the way we greet each other every day. In the Unangan language, it's called Unangan. The Western system calls us Aleut, but it's really a name given to us by our former oppressors, the Russians, and then carried on by the American government. But we call ourselves Unangan, which means the real people by the sea.
Absolutely. And we're talking about the Bering Sea up there in Alaska. Now, your traditional upbringing in this beautiful area, maybe you could describe a little bit about this beautiful place that you come from.
Well, my people have been out in the Bering Sea for over 10,000 years, and we're still there. And we developed a highly sophisticated spiritual way. We have a moon calendar, and the women would be the ones that would initiate what people call shamans, our shamans. And we even have mummified our dead, very similar to the Egyptians. And we were the only native peoples of Alaska that didn't wear footwear, even in the wintertime.
Wow.
Yeah. That's,
and it gets pretty cold there.
That's right. And, you know, it's kind of like the llamas, you know, when you've heard about sitting out in the snow and melting the snow. Well, that was us. And we developed spiritual technologies that were defined by the environment that we lived in. And one of the books that I wrote, Stop Talking, and that I co-authored with Libby Roderick, who is a colleague of mine, we call that book Stop Talking. It's really the basis of all the indigenous peoples around the world that really understand this, that the most important things in life should not be described or defined in language, that it should be experienced. And I did have a very traditional upbringing. I was the last, was in the last generation that had a fully intact traditional upbringing, where the entire village raised me. And each and every day, when I would walk out on the road in the village, you know, at starting at age 5 until age 13, I was affirmed by every adult in the village every day. And I could visit people's houses and be greeted like the long lost son every day. Am lakaya kungudawat, ungachid, kakad, come in, sit down, eat. That's often the refrain that is often told me. And I was never scolded. I was just affirmed. And the adult's responsibility was to create the space for me to learn, not tell me what to learn, how to learn, define anything. So I grew up in a way that I watched, listened, and learned. I never asked any questions. And by doing that, we expand out to the maximum of our potential as human beings. And that's, you know, the Yupik elders in Alaska, they call this a reverse society or the inside society, because we reversed all the laws for living. And one of those laws is that we are spirit beings in human form. And these young spirits are easily traumatized, so that we've gotten to the point where we've got human trauma everywhere in the world.
Exactly. Well, you know, Larian, I love the book Wisdom Keeper, because it really is your full story of how you were raised by the village. And I think it's interesting that age 4, you were given a specific name that meant Wisdom Keeper. Would you tell us that name, and how was it that they knew that you at age 4 was carrying that purpose for your life?
Well, it's not Wisdom Keeper. Kuyuk means like an arm extending out from the body, a carrier of ancient knowledge into modern times, a messenger. And that was given to me by the last Kuyuk that was left alive amongst my people. And we called each other Kuyuk. And now I'm living that legacy of my name, which is basically a messenger. And I work with elders from all over the world.
Exactly.
Indigenous elders.
And your journey, when the elders and the people in the village allowed you to just unfold your natural intelligence through your connection to nature, you learned what you needed to learn to be in action, what you are doing today. And but your story about how that came into your awareness, it wasn't like you read it in a book. You had to live it, like you said, experiential. And you learned the inherent intelligence of the human body. How did you, you know, you had an experience at 6 that really shifted your understanding about the body and its relationship to the whole big picture. Could you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yep. In those days, I loved to go underneath the bird cliffs. You know, we're an island that's 12 miles long and 5 miles wide. And all the wildlife are concentrated on the periphery of the island. And we used to be a mecca for birds. We were like one of the top 5 bird colonies in North America. And now we're about 25 or so because of declining population. But anyway, when I was a child, I would love to go underneath the bird cliffs to watch the birds. And starting at age 6. And because there'd be tens of thousands of these birds underneath one cliff. And there are all kinds of species, you know, thick-billed murres, common murres, red-legged kittiwakes, black-legged kittiwakes, pelagic cormorants, red-faced cormorants, least auklets, horned puffins, tufted puffins. All kinds of species, and they're all gathered underneath this cliff, and they would like to circle in front of those cliffs at daybreak to collect members of their species before they went out foraging. And so I'm watching. The birds sometimes would fly within inches of me, and they would fly in every direction. Can you imagine?
Yeah.
10,000 or more seabirds, and they're all together, and some of them are flying diagonally left, diagonally right, right, left, up, down, different speeds. And I noticed one time when I was 6 years old that the birds never even clipped a wing. And I said, well, that's really magical. How do they do that? I'm thinking in my child mind, well, the what is the difference between a human being and these birds? And I thought, well, the birds don't think.
Yeah.
And they don't, they're not worried about the past or the future. They're just present. I didn't have the words for it at the time, but they are a field of awareness. So I said, okay, I want to be a bird. And so I worked at not thinking. It took me a couple months, but I got to the point where not a single word would come through my head at all. And that what I was taught by the seabirds was also something that the Unangan hunters had, where we would hunt for stellar sea lions from shore to water, and in fall, winter, spring. And during that time, the air over the land is colder than the sea. And so they stay at sea, and the seas are too rough for us to use boats, so we hunt from shore to water. And the hunters, we'd usually be five or six hunters. They would take me out with them. And I'm 6 years old, 5 years old when I first started. And the hunters never got daydreamy or sleepy. We'd be out there for 7 hours. And, of course, I was a little kid, and I would get daydreamy. I would get sleepy. But the hunters never did. And they never talked a lot or moved a lot. They just sat in the basalt boulder hour after hour, fully paying attention to what's going on. And I thought that was magical. How could they do that? And then someone would say, Kawakako, sea lion coming. And mind you, we're on an island and there's 180 degrees of water. The sea lion could be anywhere, but the men would look instantly without anybody pointing or looking at one spot in the water. And I'd look and there's no sea lion. And you know, I said, well, but they're acting as if the sea lion is coming. And sure enough, the sea lion would pop up exactly where they're looking. And I thought that was magical. And this, I made the connection between the seabirds and the hunters, that when we are thinking, we're dumbing ourselves down as if we only think. We have to use the inherent intelligence of the human body, and that without interference of thought. And that's what the hunters were doing. The best hunters were ones who had that mastery.
Yeah, I remember you telling your book that you loved hanging out with your grandfather. And your grandfather would shoot, and you would go, he's shooting, but the bird's not there yet. But he knew where the bird was going to be. That was magical. So you were, in your awareness, were really connected to how nature and the oneness of nature and how humans are part of that oneness. And then I love it, at age 11, when you got your first sea lion, it was like your touch into sacredness. There was like an embodiment of sacredness about that that was a little bit different than, I mean, it was your first experience of that. Could you say something more about that?
Yeah, that profoundly changed the way that I understood the relationship to animals. And in that time, I had, my Acha would take me out hunting all the time. But he was a quarter mile away, and I'm there, and sea lion comes by. I shoot, and instantly I knew of his, that it was dead. But not because I was so sure of my shot. What happened was that some energy, lack of a better way to put it, some energy force came through my body, and I knew instantly it was the sea lion. And the sea lion did that to tell me it had intelligence, it had consciousness, and it was giving itself to me. And I thought, well, maybe I'm imagining this, you know. So I go and I get the sea lion, and I told Maacha what I experienced, and he just said, "Echom nakot," good. In that single word, he affirmed that what I was experiencing was real, that he experienced it also, okay. And all the hunters do.
That's amazing. And but then, in terms of the culture with the seal processing, and it's like it was such a contrast in your book, the way your native family embraced nature and then the business of the seal killing, and how the government, you know, kind of oppressed the people for a livelihood that was kind of against their own nature. They created a spiritual sickness for people. So it was a combination, and I'm sharing these things because you, as a leader today, and bringing people together and solving problems, it's like you figured out how to do this from your own experience of oppression and witnessing what happens when people do not honor nature. So there were some processes. You could tell us a little bit about how that oppression, you know, your experience of the impact of that oppression, and then how you became a rebel in a way that's kind of in the work you're doing today. It's like stepping stones, right? If we look back.
Yep, that's very true. I mean, I am maybe the only person you've ever met that was a slave, and was a slave of the U.S. government. We achieved our political independence in 1966, where before that we couldn't vote in U.S. elections, we couldn't vote in state elections, we didn't have citizenship, we were wards of the government but were treated as slaves. And we went through a lawsuit against the federal government that lasted 27 years. And in that lawsuit, we proved all these things that happened. But we couldn't tell the media that what was going on, because a government agent, the U.S. government agent, would censure all the letters before they went out. And censure letters that come in. And they would regulate who comes to the island. And what they were doing was killing, that they were part of an international treaty to kill fur seals, northern fur seals. And that we were the only ones that could do it efficiently, and that's, so we were a captive labor force for the U.S. government, and the men would be treated horribly every single day. I would listen to them, "You dumb blah blah blah, it takes five of you to dig a ditch," you know, and this is the way that they were demeaned every single day of their lives. And for me, growing up under that situation, for example, we had government doctors there, a government doctor, a government dentist, and the school teachers were government people. And we received rations of food, clothing, and housing. And that if you protested, then you were dealt with at a level commensurate with what you were doing, and sometimes that meant demerits that resulted in less food or less coal for heating. We had government issue clothing, government issue housing, government issued beds. They were ex-military beds, and I remember going to bed every night just being very cold. And we learned to put the blanket over us. We had one blanket, military blanket, put it over us and use the heat of our breath to keep us warm.
It's just brutal, you know. There's so much detail in the book, you know, Larry, and you went through all of that, but you also were instrumental in shifting the dependence that your people had on the government. And when they started to cut off and say, hey, we're not going to do seals because of the animal rights, and I mean, people are really confused about the whole message about how your people were with nature. And you had to reinvent this for the people, and you did. And you created a whole new conversation of how to solve problems that I think is important for you to share right now, because it's part of the work that you're doing as president of the Global Center for Indigenous Leadership and Lifeways. It's like what you learn to solve those problems in the most dismal circumstances is you shifted it such that the whole community was one of the on St. Paul Island became a robust economy because of the shift in leadership that you helped facilitate. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah. You know, first of all, I think it's important to note that I who listen to the elders, my elders, that these elders never showed any bitterness, anger, or hatred towards anybody. And that's what I took in, that because they understand that bitterness, hatred, and anger will hurt yourself and contribute to destruction of our people. And so if we're serious about helping, we don't have any bitterness, hatred, or anger. And we decided when the government was going to pull out of the Pribilof Islands, which is St. Paul is part of the Pribilof Island group of five islands. It was in 1980 when Reagan took over the presidency, and he wrote us out of the budget. Now our economy was only the government, and so he wrote us out of the budget, and we had to decide what we do, what are we going to do. We literally planned one-way tickets for all the people on the island to the mainland. And thankfully, we never had to do that. And what we decided to do was to throw out conventional wisdom about how to plan. And what we did is we created what would be a talking circle where every organization on the island had equal power and equal authority to veto anything. And we treat each other with respect. And we listen to each other without agenda. You know, today every meeting I go to is like filled with agenda. I'm thinking about what I'm going to say when somebody is talking. But no, we learn just to listen without agenda. And that everybody's got their own truth. Your truth is equally valid as my truth. And that we should treat each other in that way. And it worked. This was something that we hadn't practiced since the government arrived. But then we brought back this elder wisdom of conducting discourse and dialogue in that way. Before all the organizations, the tribal organization, the corporate organization, the city organization, were all having their own proposals. And they were fighting for it. But when we put this system in place, they no longer fought. And they were working together. And in today's society, you look at how decisions are being made. It's one-upmanship. It's the person who talks the loudest sometimes or is the most assertive that gets the floor. And it's considered uncivilized by our people. the civilized way is to quietly sit down and listen.
Exactly. Well, and this is part of the work that you're bringing to so many conferences. I heard you speak at the Pioneers Conference, and you're coming here to Portland in September 23rd and 24th. And there's an event called Indigenous Wisdom, Pathways to Deeper Awareness. And I believe at this event, over the 2 days, you're going to create an opportunity for people to experience this kind of process about what happens when people want to solve problems together. Are you going to give us an experience of that?
Yep, absolutely. The most important way to show it is for people to experience it, not talk about it.
Exactly. So giving, maybe there's questions or inquiries that gets people talking, and out of that there's a listening. And there's some sort of a process that when consensus is a given, it's not, doesn't come from a vote or anything, right? It just...
That's right. I mean, when we do this thing of listening in this circle, in this way, we don't use any words like, I disagree with you, or that's not right, you know, and these are violent terms. And we, when I watch the elders talk about some issue, one elder might say, well, something X, Y, and Z. The next elder that speaks says something positive about the last speaker and then tells his own truth or her own truth. And it might be 180 degree different than what that other person said. And then at the end, what happens invariably, I use this all the time, people, we achieve consensus, which means in principle we agree with whatever it is that we're debating. Where we began with very diverse viewpoints, but we unify that. And we come together in agreement. And when I use that system with people, it always far exceeds my individual expectation. When the answer comes from the group.
Exactly.
Not from one individual.
So that process you're going to, and you bring that to many conferences and the work that you do around climate change and bringing forward the prophecies of what we could do as human beings, let's see, become more aware of our spirit, that we're spiritual beings having a human experience, and they have an opportunity to experience that in the events that you are part of. So we're really grateful that you're coming to Portland, and this event, again, is September 23rd and 24th. It's going to be at the Native American Youth and Family Center on 5135 Northeast Columbia Boulevard. And actually, it's free. I mean, people can come. We're counting on the generosity of the attendees and the patrons. But this is a place you'll want to be if you want to be part of the emerging solution. And Alarion, we're really excited. What else can you tell people? We're running out of time now. So I'm wondering, where else would you direct people to find out more about you and your writings?
Yeah, well, I work with elders from all over the world. And the elders from around the world are saying we've got to change our consciousness now because, oops, just a minute. Because the time is short for human beings. And we've got to change now. We've got to change our consciousness now. And so that's what I'm doing. And one of the, I don't advertise myself, it's usually by word of mouth, but the foundation that helps fund me asked that I create this website called gcill.org, G-C-I-L-L.org. And it shows a lot of the things that I'm doing now. And, you know, I look forward to talking with people down there.
Exactly. Well, I know you're doing a lot of travel and you're in demand, and the time is right. There is immediacy. And I want to thank you, Ilarion, for being with us today. And for those of you who tuned in late, this is Renee Poindexter. Today, we've been visiting with Ilarion Mikurlioff, and he is the author of The Wisdom Keeper, One Man's Journey to Honor the Untold History of the Anangan People. Also, the writer of Stop Talking, Indigenous Ways of Teaching and Learning, and Difficult Dialogues. I want to thank all of the listeners, again, for tuning into Pathways Interview Program. It's broadcast and streamed via KBOO FM, Sunday mornings at 8:30 Pacific Standard Time. And please tell all your friends about Pathways and its podcast. This interview program is dedicated to personal and cultural transformation. Thanks again for tuning in and for being a part of it.